You are Locked On Jazz, your daily podcast on the Utah Jazz.
Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
It is Locked On Jazz for January 28th. Hey, it's my anniversary. The Jazz get a solid, good team win in Minnesota. Lots of indicators that this team might be really, really good. But the lead story is an earthquake heading through the NBA that will change its foundation. Anthony Davis wants out of New Orleans. It's all coming up on today's edition of Locked On Jazz. Pow! How are you? I'm David Locke, radio voice of the Utah Jazz, Jazz NBA insider. It is Locked On Jazz, your daily podcast on the Utah Jazz, giving you insight, expertise, geeky numbers, and a look around the league as well. You can get it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and you can tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On Jazz. I'm going to start with the biggest story of the day. And that is that the day has come. We've all been talking about it. It's been the conversation on the end of our bus, the back of our bus every day. It was a conversation last night while we sat for 2 hours on the tarmac, wondering what New Orleans is going to do. Anthony Davis, via his agent, Rich Paul, which really had to happen, I'll explain in a second, has informed the Pelicans he will not re-sign and would like to be traded. So let's go with the first thing. The Pelicans, as I talked about, I think, with Spence Chekits in Locked On NBA, were in this terrible circumstance whereby they could either trade Anthony Davis by this deadline, go to the offseason, offer him an extension in which he says no, and then they lose all their leverage, or they try to run it all the way out, which seems ridiculous. The problem they had was that until Anthony Davis came out and said, I'm not re-signing, it looked like they quit if they traded him at this deadline. Now that Davis has done that, he's now given them the ability to try to rebuild their franchise. Now, so that's the first part. He's going to the Lakers. Everyone's known it. The league's known it. The last time we knew something like this was the talk of LeBron going to Lakers or Hayward going to the Celtics. Like, it just, the talk was endless. Hayward to the Celtics, I don't think was as much of a done deal, but if we're honest about the retrospect, it had been talked about for a long, long time. And there's still a question of whether, you know, it might have been done, you know, you got it. The other ones we've heard about are Paul George to the Lakers, and we'll see where Kawhi Leonard ends up, right? Those have been the conversations. Paul George didn't go. The feeling around the league is that he's going to the Lakers. The question is whether another team in the NBA thinks they can make an offer to the New Orleans Pelicans that is significant enough that the Pelicans take it and they risk a year and a half of Anthony Davis in order to try to win a title and then have him stay the way the Raptors are for Kawhi and the way the Thunder were able to for Paul George. I think that's unlikely. I think by the end of February 7th, which I believe is the trade deadline, I'm getting confused with the All-Star dates and the All-Star draft and a bunch of other things, but I'm assuming February 7th is the date. I think February 4th is the All-Star draft. I think by February 7th, Anthony Davis will be a Laker. And then he and LeBron, who, when Anthony Davis became a Clutch Sports Rich Paul guy, which is LeBron's agency, it feels like that was pretty close to happening. You're grumbling. You're upset. Another super team. I hear you. It is the players' right. Right? Like, and actually, if we're getting to it, Anthony Davis is giving the Pelicans as much runway as possible when the fact is he could just hang on for another year and a half. He could do the evil thing, which is sign the extension and then demand a trade. players have to do have some individual rights where they have the ability to choose where they want to play. That's what free agency is, and NBA players have figured out how to use this to a larger extent to then pull their power early. We can all go play the ESPN trade machine. Is there another team out there that would have the guts? The Spurs are an interesting one. The Pelicans, the Wizards would be an interesting one if they were willing. They'd have to probably give up Bradley Beal, not just John Wall. Boston cannot trade for Anthony Davis unless they trade Kyrie Irving. So is Boston willing to trade Kyrie Irving for Anthony Davis? Miami has a lot of salaries but no pieces. Philadelphia is interesting. Do you think you could put Joel Embiid and Anthony Davis together and you trade Ben Simmons? You trade Jimmy Butler? Free agent, I'm not sure New Orleans would want to do that. They probably don't get to sign, but Jimmy Butler is obsessed with getting that money. These are the deals that New Orleans will investigate before taking the Laker package. These are the, again, and they are whether Washington can put something together, whether Philadelphia stuns the world by trading one of their big three, and Butler would have to be the one that they find interesting, whether the Spurs do something that New Orleans deems them with a chance. New Orleans ownership is in a unique circumstance in which Tom Benson passed. The wife is now running the team. The wife seems very reasonable and intelligent and on point with some of her comments, particularly her comment in regards to hey, if he doesn't want to be here, we'll move forward instead of all the bluster. So, but can they afford to rebuild in New Orleans, or is this the part that sends New Orleans on their way to Seattle, Mexico City, Vancouver, or somewhere else? Is this the end of New Orleans as an NBA franchise? It's a real chance. Staying with the Anthony Davis trade possibilities, Dallas will try to venture into this thing with some Dennis Smith Jr., DeAndre Jordan. I don't think that has enough to it. I don't know if Denver can put together enough pieces to try to do something to put him next to Nikola Jokic, and you're certainly not going to trade Jokic with the fear that Anthony Davis is going to leave. Houston will try to put something together to try to win a championship and see if they can go get, can they pull off a Clint Capella, Eric Gordon deal that makes New Orleans think that they've got some pieces there. Portland will offer Yusuf Nurkic and CJ McCollum if they thought there was any chance he might re-sign and they could win a championship there, and then he's by the shoe. But the Lakers are the looming team. Everyone else, these other teams are all going to make a play. The wild card to me is if there's some way the Clippers can put something together and they get him already in L.A. And then they have the piece that lures Kevin Durant or Kawhi Leonard to play next to. I don't know how they do it. They have plenty of contracts that they could put together to have it happen. Tobias is at 14, Gallinari's at 21, Gortat's at 13. Bradley's at 12, Lou Williams at 8. They'd have to, I don't know their pick situation, but I think they're a crazy wild card in all of this. Okay, now let's move to part two. After he's traded, what are they doing? I think New Orleans has to go into free, unless they trade him in one of these deals, into somewhat of a free flow rebuild. And I like a bunch of their pieces. Jrue Holiday is an interesting player who is a great pick-and-roll player. I actually think under a different coaching system would be even better. Is making $25 million a year. Would be an interesting piece of a puzzle at 28 years old. Frankly, if Mike Conley's on the board, Holiday pulls, is bigger, younger, might be as good, if not better, probably better, averaging 21 a game at 48% from the field, only 33% from three. has definitely profited by playing next to Anthony Davis, but I think could be even better in a better system and becomes available. Has a Jazz tie. Quinn Snyder coached him when he was a rookie. Nikola Mirotic was a name that was bounced around last year because it was clear he's going to be traded. He has not had a very inspiring year. He has not stayed particularly healthy, but he is a true stretch four. There aren't a lot of them. He's only played 32 games this year. His shooting percentage has kind of been what it's been. There are mixed reports on his commitment level, both in when he was in Chicago, he got punched by Bobby Portis, and none of his teammates were upset about it. It was kind of this moment that everyone talks about in the NBA. Solomon Hill's on a 12-year expiring contract. I'm not sure there's a lot of interest. Etuan Moore's really good. Etuan Moore is an interesting player if they're really unloading and you can... I don't know if they can get a pick for Etuan Moore, but maybe. He's 6'4". He does a lot of different things. He shoots 42% from three. If I was an NBA team that was close to pushing through and needed shooting, which everyone needs, I would be considering him on a two-year $8 million deal and be maybe willing to get a draft pick or a previous pick. Darius Miller is an interesting player. He's a one-year, $2 million player. He is nothing but a catch-and-shoot guy. He doesn't have a dribble-drive game. He doesn't have any wiggle. He's 6'8", 225. He's probably a little limited defensively. He's a career 39% three-point shooter. He would be interesting to me as well. Not sure what I'm giving up for him. And that's probably it. Frank Jackson's going to be good, but if they're rebuilding, they're going to hold on to him. Julius Randle's really interesting. Having a great year, become a hell of a player, limited in a little bit of what he can do just because of his lack of outside shooting, but plays really hard, rebounds hard, and averages 20, and is interesting. So there are three folds to this Anthony Davis story, and it's just massive. One is, I think he's put New Orleans in the best position for them possible. But now, do they just go to the Lakers and pull the Laker deal? Or does one of these other teams I've mentioned jump in? I'm curious to see if Portland would really gamble. Portland can put a package together of Jusuf Nurkić and CJ McCollum that on one level gives a chance for their franchise to fall apart if it doesn't work. On the other level, gives New Orleans a pretty good player, though I'm not a huge CJ fan. There's actually New Orleans would have to put more into that package, by the way. So Etuan Moore or someone like that, or Solomon Hill, or maybe I don't see them with a really bad contract anywhere other than Etuan Moore's next year. So maybe you throw Etuan Moore in there. Moore would be brilliant next to Damian Lillard. That's a hell of a trade. Is Nurkić and CJ McCollum then with Drew Holiday gives New Orleans still a chance to compete. They're not in a rebuild. Both McCollum and Nurkić have signed long-term. And Portland makes a run with Dame Lillard and Anthony Davis and decides that they're going to run the next, 18 months with those two and see if they can do it. Be a hell of a decision. That's the most intriguing one to me. The Clippers are the other one. I don't know exactly what the deal is. Maybe it's in New Orleans. If I'm New Orleans, I want guys with contracts because I've already proven I can't re-sign guys. The Boston Celtics cannot get involved in this unless they trade Kyrie Irving. That's the other thing that's fascinating. Tells you that Anthony Davis is not that interesting going to Boston. He's interested in going to the Lakers. That will be the next story, is Anthony Davis will leak out that he wants to play for the Lakers, trying to kill the trade market when these other rumors start. And then the impact is, how do you profit off of this? The loser in this deal, by the way, I think is Memphis. Because there's a chance Drew Holiday becomes available before the end of this process, Mike Conley's value has just dropped. All right, that was a long stretch there, a little longer than planned. Let me let you learn a little bit about what's going on with our friend Spencer Nelson and Iron Gate Global Advisors. I'd like to introduce you to Iron Gate Global Advisors, financial group out of Salt Lake City. I found out about them from Spencer Nelson, former Utah State Aggie, great basketball player. And beyond his jump shot, he's got an MBA. He's worked in private equity. He's got experience working in Wall Street, accounting and financing degrees. And he's now working with Iron Gate Financial. And here's why.
As I evaluated my options and looked at different firms, it became clear to me that the real question I needed to ask was, who would I trust managing my portfolio? And as I got to know Brett and I got to know Brian, I was able to see how they differentiate themselves from so many other wealth management firms and the real value that they create. And it was clear to me that I wanted to work with them.
Brian's a long-term financial expert. Brett, who's been in the business forever, has got an options background. They have a strategy, a direction, and a process. And most importantly, as a small firm, they understand your journey. If you'd like to find out more about Iron Gate, give Spencer a call at 888-591-0334. That's 888-591-0334, or email him at spencer@igga.com. Anytime we're talking investing, understand that past performance isn't indicative of future results. Also, options may not be for everyone. They have different risks. Make sure you consult a professional before doing anything with them. Do your due diligence. Now let's go to last night's Jazz win. I thought that was just a really solid win. That was what a good team does. Minnesota is limited with... there were a lot of ways this was a good team win. One, Minnesota was limited because of their lack of point guards, and I thought the Jazz took advantage of that. Beating a team twice in 48 hours is really, really difficult. I don't think if they're healthy, you can do it. So you're taking advantage of their weakness. They're playing Jared Bayless and Terrell as their two-point guards. They're not good. And so they have a weakness you can expose. You expose it two games in a row. Ricky Rubio was great last night. He's got to be good against that. I mean, Ricky Rubio's got to be better than Jared Bayless and Terrell, or it's a really big problem. So the Jazz do exactly that. So there's the first good team win. That you beat a team that had a weakness, you're able to take advantage of it. The second reason it's a good team win, and when I mean good team, I don't mean like a group. I mean like a good team wins this game, is that you're playing an undermanned team twice in 48 hours. You have the focus to win it. The third one is the third quarter. They went bananas shooting in the third quarter, and the Jazz answered. They hit their final two threes to close the first half, and then proceed to hit seven of their next 8 3-point shots. The Jazz led for a brief moment when the half started by three, and then it starts. And these are bad shooters. Okogie, who is not a good shooter, hits a three. Karl Anthony Towns, who's a great shooter, hits a three. Jared Bayless makes a 21-foot pull-up. Jared Bayless makes another three. He's now hit three in a row at that point. Wiggins goes to the line. Somehow the Jazz kind of are staying above water on this and still lead the game. Then Bayless hits a three. Saric makes a three, and they take a 71-69 lead. I mean, this is an onslaught. Wiggins makes a three. He's not a good shooter. And in the meantime, the Jazz are still answering. All those threes have hit, and Wiggins gives them a one-point lead because Donovan's just hit an 18-footer. Rubio's made a layup. Ingles throws a great alley-oop to Gobert in that process. Donovan goes to the line two times. The Jazz are answering, fundamentally staying in control, not being overwhelmed by the circumstances, staying inside of who they are, playing the game right. Jay Crowder hits a three. We're suddenly back up four. Donovan Mitchell turns it over. Luol Deng hits a three. We're down one. Donovan answers with a 14-footer. Wiggins makes a layup to make it 81-82. Royce gets a great layup off a Donovan Mitchell assist. And then we take the lead at 84-83 and never look back. And this is a little bit of where we also just kind of held them off until Okogie came in for Andrew Wiggins. Karl Anthony Towns had to go out of the game. They just don't have enough guys. They're injured. This is the weakness part of it. So we were good enough to stay in the game during the midst of that. Then when they're not having Jeff Teague, not having Tyus Jones, not having Derrick Rose to carry the second team shows up, we took total advantage. So that's in my mind what a good team does. The other one last night was shot distribution. You've heard about this from me endlessly because I believe in it passionately, and I actually really think we won to some extent both the last two games because of how great our shot distribution is. Last night, I believe, was our, and there's a site that actually now tell me, and I haven't figured it out yet, so I'll have to. Last night, I believe, was our best shot distribution of the year. 85% of our shots were smart shots. Our offense was incredible. We were in the 95th percentile last night in offense, 94th percentile in shooting. Didn't turn the ball over. We were amazing last night. 43% of our shots at the rim, 42% of our shots as threes, for 85% of our shots being smart shots. We were in the third percentile of mid-range shots taken. And then it gets even better. Of our 14 mid-range shots last night, 10 of those were taken by Donovan. Donovan taking a mid-range shot is fine. Here's why. One, he's good at it. Maybe most importantly, he's good at it. Number two is not that he's just good at it. He opens up other things for other players when he's there. If Ricky Rubio is not going to the rim, not taking his layups, not Nash dribbling, and just taking that mid-range shot, it's not a threat to anyone. No, the team, it doesn't bend the defense in any way, shape, or form. It's why it's so important that the coaches have gotten Rubio to start Nash dribbling, and why it's important for Rubio to go to the rim and make layups, as he has in the second half of the season. But Donovan, one, is good at it. He's a 45% mid-range shooter. He's a 40% floater range shooter. The 40% floater range is not great, but it opens up the 231 shots at the rim he's taking, which only Derek Favors and Rudy Gobert have taken more. Right? It opens up the assist game that we're seeing out of Donovan right now, because when he gets in that pocket and the defense bends to him, now he's swinging the cross-court pass to Jay Crowder for the wide-open three when Minnesota overshifts, and the Jazz are getting 16 corner threes last night. The Jazz corner three frequency right now is through the roof, a little bit because of the teams they're playing. But this is where Quinn and the system is just incredible. When a team has a defined weakness, such as, frankly, our last three opponents, Denver, Minnesota, Minnesota, where they allow an inordinate amount of corner threes because they're an overshifting defense, then the Jazz take 16 corner threes against Denver, 11 against Minnesota, and 16 against Minnesota. Those are crazy big numbers. We're only a 36% three-point shooting corner three shooting team. It's actually low. But it's such a good shot. It spreads the defense. Quinn was talking the other day about the idea of a spacing assist, like having the guys in the corners and taking 16 threes is why Donovan gets to the rim the next time. There's a great moment in the first Minnesota game where Okogie, who's a rookie, comes off of Kyle Korver in the corner, and Donovan drives, hits Korver, corner three. Later in the game, in the third quarter, Donovan drives and Okogie just holds on Korver in a layup for Donovan. And Saunders calls a timeout, and Okogie's like, I don't know what to do. And that's the essence of what Quinn Snyder does offensively to put a team in that circumstance where they have to make those decisions. And that's, again, to my point last night of just kind of being what a good team does and wins. The defense last night was not great. Karl Anthony Towns is a real problem, and they shot the lights out. In fact, last night, with the way Minnesota played offensively, to me, had every chance of being a loss. And somehow the Jazz got through it, which, again, fits into my good team win. There are some indicators right now that the Jazz are really, really good. As was the case for most of last year, quite honestly, I'm not sure I'm totally willing to go there, but I will give them to you next and let you decide whether you want to go there or not. It's up to you. Today's show is brought to you in part by Slow the Flow. I'm telling you, it doesn't feel like it. I'm sitting out here, I'm looking outside, there's snow everywhere. Why am I worrying about this? Because we live in a desert, and it's really, really important. So we want you to increase your WER, your water efficiency rating. I don't really like PER. You never hear me talk about PER. But I'm going to tell you that I like WER. WER is how you boost your water efficiency rating. Here are the ways. Install a low-flow toilet. You'll save 0.3 gallons per flush. Doesn't seem like a lot, but it's the same thing as shot distribution. You start, and hopefully you're shooting correctly in the toilet. Yeah, right. But you just start on little tiny incremental pieces, and it helps you win the ball games. Helps the environment a great deal here. Another way is taking showers instead of baths. A bath takes 70 gallons of water. A shower, 12 to 25 gallons of water. A five-minute shower, start reducing it down. Let's say a five-minute shower is 25 gallons of water or so, and you reduce that down to 4 minutes. Pretty significant. Little by little, little changes make the difference to make you a WER and all-star levels of being a WER all-star. So please help out Slow the Flow. Maybe you'll be in Charlotte playing in the WER All-Star Game. That doesn't really exist. WER. Head to slowtheflow.org. Slow the Flow. Save H2O. We have a lot of indicators that say we're pretty good. We'll see whether they turn out to be true. Let's start with since the Kyle Korver trade on November 30th. Since that time, the Utah Jazz have played 29 games. They are 19-10. In those 29 games, just trying to be fair, the Jazz have played, I'm counting right now, it hurts me, 7 of their 29 games against teams that are not very good. Okay, but that's, and one of them was in Mexico City, which, you know, I think was a disadvantage. That's about the rate, 20 of your 82 games, which is 1/4, that's 24%. So we're right on what is a fair schedule. In that time period, since Korver has joined the team, we've played 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 13 road games and 15 home games. Okay, this is a pretty even schedule here. We're 19-10 in that time period. If you do that for 82 games, you win 53-54 games. Our net rating during that time period is the fourth best in the NBA at 8.0. The only teams that are better are the Celtics at 8.8, the Bucks at 8.8. Nice to be in the Eastern Conference. The Warriors are tied with us at 8.0. Our defense in that time period is now the second best in the NBA. Milwaukee is better. Our offense is 12th. Our offense is getting closely similar to what I envision as a good offensive team, which is everyone's just above average. Our pace of play in that time period is right on league average, just because I was curious to check. There's no real correlation there. Our shooting is 9th best in the league. That is because we take smart shots. That is all that is. Against Western Conference teams on the road, for the season, we are 9-7. The Warriors are the only other team in the Western Conference that has a winning record against Western Conference teams on the road. They're 9-6. Okay, here's another little tidbit for you. This has not been talked about a great deal. I was playing with a site that my assistant Connor Varney found, a broadcast assistant, and then playing with it. And Quinn doesn't totally agree with me on this, but to me, on December 12th, we came home from Oklahoma City. We lost to San Antonio and Oklahoma City. On December 12th, to me, it looks like Quinn changed the rotation and started to match Donovan and Rudy for about an average of 30 minutes a night. 10 of them with the starters, 22 other minutes, and then Ingles and Favors matched for 10 minutes a night, and then they're kind of just getting through the other period of time. We'll talk about this more tomorrow on the show, since I won't have anything new, and this will be a good thing to have. But if you go to December 12th, and there's some reasons why this took place, and we'll get into it. If you go to December 12th, and again, the schedule now At this point, the Jazz play Orlando and Mexico City. They play Cleveland and Detroit and Orlando again, and Chicago and Detroit and Cleveland. So suddenly, eight of these games are against not – eight of the 23 are against not as good teams, which gets to be a little bit higher than the 25, you know, which is now up to about 33%, I think. So this is a little bit of a soft schedule in this period of time. The Jazz are 16-7 with the second best differential in the NBA. And the defense is number one in the league. And the offense is 17th. And the pace of play is right on league average again. So this, with a little softer schedule, we bump up a little bit. But we're 16-7 in this time period, after by which Quinn, I think, changed the rotation, or at least, well, the rotation changed. And this is factual, that in this time period, and there are some explanations, I'll explain why tomorrow. Rudy Gobert and Donovan play 30 minutes together. Rudy and Donovan without Favors play 10 minutes together. Favors and Ingles with no Rudy Gobert play 10 minutes together. And then they kind of try to string together the other minutes of the game. And I've kind of come up with 47 of their 48 minutes. And that's since the Miami game, and they're 16-7. Again, that schedule is a little soft, so it's a little misleading. But if you were to win at that rate for a season, you're a 57-win team. Might be pretty good. Let me throw this one at you. This is part of the game, but I think it's worth referencing. If Donovan Mitchell plays, despite all the other things, even Kyle the Kyle Korver acquisition that certainly changed who we are, some of this is without Kyle, we're 28-19 on the season when Donovan plays. Remember, Donovan didn't play some games. That takes you out to being a 47-win team, which isn't wowing you. But then you remember that he didn't finish the Laker game, which we lost, and he didn't finish the Minnesota game that we lost. And you begin to wonder whether or not and he sits out the Sacramento-Indiana game. And by the way, we'll get into this, that rotation change happens in Quinn's mind a little earlier with Korver's arrival and with Donovan getting healthy. Since Donovan came back from the hamstring after taking two games off, he's played 30 games. He's averaging 24 points a game. He's getting 5 rebounds, 4 assists. He's shooting 43% from the field and 35% from 3. That's the season I think everybody thought he was going to have. What he's doing right now is insane. Since Quinn pulled him in Detroit and whatever happened at halftime, there is a shooting session with Kyle Korver right before we leave for that Toronto trip that Donovan talks about having a pretty big impact. But since that day, 30 points a game, 5 rebounds, 6 assists, 46% from the field, 41% from 3, and the Jazz are 10-2. Something happened in Detroit. The season changed for the second straight year in Detroit. So there's some indicators we're pretty good. Lots there, my friends. Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll dig into this rotation change tomorrow, and then we'll head to Portland. We are back home. We came home. Got home barely last night. Have a great one. Thanks very much to Slow the Flow, as well as Iron Gate Global Advisors and our other sponsors on today's program. Appreciate you supporting those sponsors. You can go listen to Locked On NBA today, get the latest, plus the breakdown of Locked On Pelicans with Jake Madison. Have a great one. Talk to you soon.